We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/hackitout. Just go to Indeed.com/hackitout right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Hack It Out Golf podcast. Indeed.com/hackitout. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So consistently shooting in the 70s, breaking 80 continues this week. We're going to talk mental game. And if there isn't three mental people who can talk about mental game, I don't know who there is. Like, we're
fully
there.
Qualified.
Yeah.
Lou, what stats have you got? How can you possibly see what's going on in their heads in a calculator? I don't understand how a calculator looks inside a head.
You have the wrong calculator. Yeah. You have the wrong calculator.
This calculator didn't do anything.
So I have a couple of things that I want to go through here. The first one is really interesting. I looked at players in Arcos, scratch players. So good players in Arcos, 0.0 index players. And I found rounds where they were playing well. They were at even par or better through at least the seventh hole, through the 11th hole.
So we're rolling.
Full knee jangle time. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, they're scratch players, so it's not. They're playing
all
well.
Knees jangle, Lou. All knees jangle.
Yes, they do.
They do. So they're scratch players. They're playing, you know, solid golf. And they get through hole 7 all the way maybe up to hole 11, and they're at even par.
Okay.
And then what did they do on the 8th hole or on the 11th hole or, you know, whatever hole they happen to be on?
Yeah.
What happens? How does their scoring change depending on how they do on, let's just for this example, say the 10th hole. So they play the front 9 even par. They get to 10. What do they do the rest of the way when they make a birdie or better? They average 1.06 over par for the back 9 if they make birdie or better on the 10th hole. And now if they make double or worse on the 10th hole, for the rest of the round, they average 1.47 shots over par when they make double or worse. And when you look at this across all of these holes, hole 8, 9, 10, 11, there is a huge uptick in performance after they make a double. An uptick as in they got worse. They start playing worse. So let's take another hole as an example.
Oh, so sorry, because I'm getting lost a little bit there. So I'm sure the listeners are as well. Just to clarify, what you're saying is if they get through argument, you're talking 9 holes, they double 10, the wheels come off in theory.
The wheels come off. Yeah. This is basically a way to look at the wheels coming off through the
wheels,
numbers.
Yeah, that's someone's got the wrench out. A double bogey size wrench and just undone a couple of the nuts and the wheels flown off in it.
I appreciate you dumbing it down. To me, talking these numbers is just second nature. I like that you're able to put it in the context of not a smart person. It's perfect for you.
I can play that part. I can play that part. Wow, if you need me to.
Yes, we know. And I thank you for it.
I'm a good actor, you see.
I thank you for it. So here's another example. They're even par through the 8th hole. They make a double on 9. So they're playing great through 8. They make a double on 9. They play the back 9 and 2.26 shots over par. If they were to have made birdie or better on 9, they play the back 9 at just 1.09 shots over par. So there is this huge difference depending on what they score on that hole and how they play the rest of the way. And there's a huge gap here between bogey and double bogey. So they play the back 9 at 2.26 over par if they make double or worse. But if they make bogey, it's only 1.52. They're able to handle the bogey. Making a double on nine is costing them more than three quarters of a shot. Three quarters of a shot versus if they make a bogey on nine. And the interesting part about this is they were playing well up until that point. I only have the scratch numbers here, but I looked at this for all skill levels in this same shape, the same pattern holds where people are playing well. The wheel, you know, something happens and they make a double or worse, and then the wheels come off and they play a lot worse compared to making a bogey or some other score. So wow. I thought it was a really interesting way to look at that.
That is an interesting way of looking at that. And you're kind of, so your eighth, your ninth, your 10th or 11th hole example that you're saying there, that's arbitrary. You're just looking at they've done well for some point and then something happens, isn't it? You're not saying.
Yeah, that. I didn't want to look at like the first three holes. I wanted to have a chunk of golf, you know, where they're playing at least almost nine holes of golf and they were playing well up until that point. So it wasn't like some fluke where they, you know, made a 30 footer on the first hole, chipped in on the second hole and they're even par through four, but you know, they're just hanging on by a thread. Yeah. It's tough to stay even through eight or nine holes by, you know, making a whole series of 20 footers or chipping in or, you know, crazy things like that. You have to be playing relatively decently to be even par through that many holes, which is why I picked that cutoff.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now you've got numbers there that back up wobbles, wheels coming off, knees jangling, something's happening and triggering in their game, their mental game possibly, which is what we're talking about there, that's making them not deal with that issue by the looks of those numbers.
Is that right? And I can identify with this. The flailing bits start to flail a little bit more when this happens to me. So a couple other ones. The next one I want to talk about, tour players. This doesn't apply to Greg. This is tour players after missing a really short putt, which Greg never misses.
Never happened.
Yeah,
he's legitimately the best putter in Shotlink history from 3 to 5 feet. Legitimately, nobody's better. The numbers support that. So, but I'm talking about shorter putts.
Give that man a badge.
Yeah, give him a badge.
Yeah,
a cape. Give him a cape.
Ooh, that'd be your next event. You should play in your next event with a big badge saying that. Yeah. By the way, I'm the best putter.
As made by Lou Stagner. That'd be great.
All right, so what happens after players at Greg's level miss a short putt? And I want to say for this, I define short putt as 28 inches or less, so 2 feet, 4 inches or less, which tour pros very rarely miss those.
Yeah.
So what happens after they miss those? And what I did was I looked at the next tee shot. So you miss a short putt. Now you have to walk to the next tee and relatively soon thereafter hit a tee shot.
Yeah.
And how did they perform? And as a group, they did not perform well. They performed really poorly.
There's so their a next hole tee shot there, isn't there?
Yeah, strokes gained per shot, it was down significantly, and I looked at it a few different ways. You know, just overall, what did they gain or lose in strokes on this tee shot? And then I looked at their performance on the tee compared to how they typically perform in the season. And then I looked at how they performed on that tee shot compared to how they were performing that day for the instances where I had enough drives. I couldn't do this on the first or second hole. So I waited until like the eighth or ninth hole or later. And I was able to get a few drives that day to get a general sense of how they were striking it with the driver. And every way I look at it, they perform much worse than they typically do. That to me is another example of a tour pro having to overcome this situation of, I can't believe I just threw a shot away. Because, you know, Greg, on the very rare occasion you miss two footers, which you've probably missed one or two in your career, like that doesn't, you know, that's tough for a tour pro to deal with, I imagine.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, it just can put you in a bit of a spin, and it's just it can be quite shocking. And it's just so much of this comes down to me, and it's things that are happening that weren't in the plan, right? You know, because I think all of us sometimes have a little plan in our head for how things are going to go, and sometimes when you strike adversity, where something, because we're human, we just make mistakes. You don't know how to deal. And the really great players, when things go awry, particularly if they've been playing well, they get back on the track really quickly and start playing well again. And that always, to be honest, that amazes me sometimes when you see, you know, some of the game's greatest players can hit it wildly offline and they don't question that. They just go, oh, well, that was a bad swing, and then they flush the next one. It's a real skill, and there's some things you can work on to help with that.
Yeah, and that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, that it is a skill. Like, putting is a skill. Go on, Lou. You were going to say something?
Yeah, I just had one other. You can continue on here. I have one other item that I wanted to run through on the stats side.
Yeah,
that,
go for it.
Okay, so the next thing is, and again, this is with some tour players. I looked at how they perform when they're in the lead, tour players. And I don't mean just in the lead going into the third round or the fourth round. I was able to look at the leaderboard throughout the course of the day, every minute of every round of every day, and find the players that got into the lead. So let's say they scratched their way into the lead, you know, at some point in the second round. How did they perform when they were in the lead for those holes that they played when they're at the top of the leaderboard? And as a group, they start to do worse, which is, you know, really interesting to look at. Now, obviously, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to play well. But as a group, once people get into the lead, they perform worse than they're typically performing. And that makes a lot of sense when you step back and think about the typical tournament that you're watching and all of the players that crawl their way into the lead and have held the lead at some point in the tournament and then fall out of the lead. There's a lot of players falling out of the lead, contributing to this overall poorer performance in that situation. And I think most of that is driven by the situation that they end up in. Like, oh no, I'm in the lead, and now they have to deal with some added pressures when that happens.
Yeah, yeah. Greg, obviously you have lived in this pressure-filled place for years. And joking aside, you know, you've won events and you've had to make cuts, and you try to, you know, you do support your whole life and family with playing golf. I mean, how do you, the mental side for you? It's important for everyday amateurs. It's important for people who are trying to, you know, break 80, shoot in the 70s consistently. What are you doing that people could think about and take to their, you know, games? How are you dealing with it?
Yeah, I got quite a few ideas and things, because I've worked with about four different sports psychologists since I was about 17 years old, is when I first sort of started laying on the couch telling them about my life. And there's a lot to unpack there. That's another time though. But it's there's some things you can do that I've learned over the years, some tricks and traits that could really help you. Some things we can talk about, emotional control. Like, you want to find the right emotional state for you. So think about Tiger Woods versus Dustin Johnson. Tiger looks like he's lit on fire. Jordan's another one. Looks like he's sort of a cat on a hot tin roof. And Dustin Johnson looks like he's not sure what the tournament's even going on. So you need to try and work towards the emotional state that is good for you. For me, it's like I try and move towards more of a fiery competitor is kind of what I try and tap into. There's lots of things you can do. I really recommend people try and imagine what the winner's going to be like, or what a successful version of you is going to be like. Very often we're very good at imagining what someone else can do, but we can't imagine us doing it. Right. And so, you know, the winner of an event or someone who's going to be really successful in your competition or getting your handicap down, they're not going to be panicked, not going to be super mad or super excited. They're just going to be kind of even keeled. And you can start to learn some different ways to go about that and start just sometimes just planning, right, for how you're going to be on the golf course. Are you going to be really mad and angry and fretting, or are you going to be like, hey, I'm just going to be chill. I'm going to trust that I've just played seven great holes, particularly in the example Lou's talking about here. You just played beautifully and you've made a mistake. Well, welcome to golf. That happens. Yeah. Now get back on track. And if you have a plan in place for how you're going to be during the day, that can really help.
These are practices that you've practiced. These are things that you've practiced to get better at. You have a certain amount of, understanding and experience of how you want to manage yourself. But I think I'm right in saying you've actually practiced or trying to get better at this as a skill. Is that fair?
Still working on it today, Mark. Like I'll have jobs that I have written in my yardage book for how I want to be out on the golf course, because I'm a nervy guy, right? Even though I sound cool, calm, and collected, I'm actually a pretty nervy guy, right?
Can I just interrupt there? Sorry, you mean I'm on the golf course? There's a little bit of element of the wheels could come off in the back of your head. Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, I fought that my whole life. Yeah,
I think most golfers could relate to that, because anyone from those early stats that Lou was spitting out, they're going to be going, this is all fun for 9 hours, but I'm just waiting for this the wheels to come off. To hear you say that, it's really interesting.
Yeah, and look, I've dealt with it. What you'll find is whatever your personality is or whatever type of person you are will bleed through into your game. So I'm a pretty nervy guy. I'm a high anxiety kind of guy more often than not. So that bleeds through into my game. And how I manage that is I do things like I've worked really hard on just breathing techniques and things like that. That's common sense.
Like that, yeah.
But I've worked really hard on visualization. I visualize myself moving kind of smooth. I never look smooth. I look rushed all the time. But in my mind, I feel like I'm just moving around pretty cool, you know?
And your swing looks pretty smooth. That's not fair. Your movement does look classic and smooth.
Yeah, I'd say more just the controlling your physiology in between shots, right? So not walking like you're in a rush. I have a tendency to walk like I'm in a rush when I hit it offline, and I have to consciously stop and just go, the ball's not going anywhere, man, just chill. And then, because what I've found throughout my career is I make a poor decision if I rush to the ball, right? Okay. So I take my time and just chill. Some of the other things you can do, I learned from one particular psychologist. He explained it to me this way. He said, all of us are hardwired to answer the question that we ask of ourselves. We just have to ask the right question. So he would ask me questions like, what's a successful day look like for you? And for all of us, your mind automatically should go towards something that leads to a great day. And for some people, it's really simple. I just want to break 80 tomorrow. Right. Well, then it leads to the next question. How are you going to go about that? How are you going to be all these questions? If you ask the right ones, your brain will start. What's a good target for you on this first tee shot? What's a good feeling for you on this first tee shot? Those are the things you can ask yourself to move you in a direction that's the right direction. There's also wrong questions. Why do I suck at this? Right.
Yeah.
And you'll also find those answers.
Why is that Lego so tough to make?
Yes. Throw that thing across the room and put the engine upside down.
Where is that wing gone for that X-wing?
those are the kind of things that I thought were pretty cool that I've learned. But quite often you can just spend some time before you go play, if it's a big day for you, or you can ask yourself, what am I going to be like if I get going really well? Like in this example we're talking about here, if you get going well, things get amped up. And that may not be, it might feel uncomfortable, and you kind of have to welcome that. You got to want to be uncomfortable sometimes in golf, because you tend to default back to what feels normal. And sometimes that's just average, right? So there's plenty to unpack there, but I've been doing this for years, and the goal is to get the best out of yourself, right? And that doesn't just mean physically, that means mentally as well.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Yeah. And how many of the other guys on tour is this relevant to? Obviously, it's relevant to everyone, because everyone is using, grey matter to play golf. But how many of them are actually caring or working on this? Is it still quite a small amount that you think would be actually using this in a way to try to improve still?
I
certainly see it in the amateur world as a very untapped area.
Yeah.
Is it the same on the pro world or not?
No, I'd say... probably a third of the guys I talk to, and I talk to a few. If you ask them if they're using a sports psych or have used a sports psych, they're talking to these people. I have, you know, the guy I've used now, the advantage he has is he's not just book smart. His name's Neil Smith. He actually won Q School. He's been a professional golfer. So he understands.
So he's coming at it from
he knows what it's like to hold the grip, right, and under a lot of pressure. So that's more than just book smarts, which I think is an advantage. And so, there's lots and lots of, I think at a base level, I think a lot of amateurs could just benefit from knowing what feels or technique ideas that you can focus on when you are twitchy or nervous, knowing what you need to do to be successful, I think is really, or have a chance to be successful. So whether that's a feel with a club or a driver, usually minor rhythm based, but it could be anything really. And it's something to go to when you get nervous. And the other thing is just like so often I see people, what's your target? And they say the fairway. And I'm like, no, can we pick something just a little bit specific and get a little more.
People are scared to though, aren't they? Because they know they literally are scared they're getting rid of the planet. So to be that precise, you know, with my tennis, when I relayed it to me playing tennis, they would be like, where are you going to serve this ball? I'm literally, well, I've had a few double faults, so I just want it in the box. I would relate that comment to, I think, cool, my amateurs say that and I tell them not to. And then in my tennis, if I'm concentrating on trying to hit, you know, this one's going to go out wide, this one's going down the middle, this one's going in the body, it takes a bit more time and I've got to be braver, but it definitely allowed me to focus a lot more. Even though I didn't hit those spots, I found I hit less double faults, basically.
Right.
So I do think some amateurs are scared to pretend that they care, almost.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a valid point. And I think if that releases the tension, then I'm all on board with it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
Totally.
Yeah. If that's what you need to say to yourself to release tension, then that's okay. This is all negotiable, right? The goal is a free swing towards something that resembles a target.
Like that.
It's really, really challenging. Yeah. And you're right. I don't think a lot of amateurs are really that keen on learning about themselves a little bit.
You've got to expose yourself.
Yeah,
it
does.
You've got to expose yourself a bit. It's like being an artist. You've got to do a painting and then you've got to show people and showing people's art because someone's going to go, I hate that. That's stupid. Yeah. Well, I like that colour. You know, that's tough to do for people to reveal themselves that way.
Yeah.
The best thing from what you've said there for me, though, Greg, and I'm written it down, I think I might keep it in my vocab forever. Lou, I know you've studied a lot on this and I guess we could call you our book smart. He was using that as a negative term, and you are the book smart.
I want to know if Neil Smith has ever come down the last few holes on a Wednesday night.
Exactly.
What does he know?
League play.
Q what does school, he know? My rear end. We're talking Wednesday night league here. So, Lou, come on. Tell. I know you've gone down this rabbit hole, and you're still down it, I think. And we've had some in-depth conversations. You've got some good things to say on this subject.
I do. I want to touch on one thing Greg said around moving in between shots. What you won back in 2016 at Barracuda.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great video of you lumbering up the hill, looking like you may not make it up the hill, and your caddy's holding you by the waist and pushing you up the hill.
Yeah, thanks. I think you guys have posted
I want to
that.
Know, is Thank that... Is that an example of you walking slowly, so slowly that you needed help up the hill?
That's
He's
more
doing
like
so that just well, old he didn't
age.
Want it to
I'm end. Old. Give me a push.
That's what I thought.
Lou, I believe I've repeatedly told you on this pod, I only like to tease others. I don't like to be teased. That's the rule.
Exactly. respect the Greg rules, Lou.
Yeah. Number two Greg in the world.
Yeah.
Number two Greg in the world.
Well, it is.
If you drop to number three, the gloves come off.
Exactly. Anything could be said then.
Yeah. It's off limits.
Go on then, Lou. What have you got for us?
This is a topic that I'm very book smart on.
Yeah. I am keeping that. when you text me some number and I feel like it's different, I'm going to just say book smart. And if I'm right,
I'm sitting over here in my chair going, you know what? I got so much good info. I got a certification on this. Yeah. And then Greg lays out the old book smart comment. And I shrunk down to about a foot tall. Anyway, so I have spent a lot of time on this over the last few years. I got to meet a guy named Izzy Justice, Dr. Izzy Justice. He is a sports neuroscientist. And he's written a few books on this, and he works with professional athletes. He works with some golfers. He works with athletes from every sport, including things like NASCAR. And he applies his background in neuroscience to sports performance. And after getting to know him, I had an opportunity to go through his certification program for coaches. And it was really fascinating for me. I've read a lot of the sports psychology books out there, and I always walked away from them. You know, my math brain wanted to know a little bit more, wanted to understand a little bit more as to what was going on. So I don't want to make any of this sound like I'm bashing sports psychology, because I'm not. I think it's incredibly useful. But going through and understanding the neuroscience helped me to put the dots together, and it was extremely effective to me. And understanding what's going on in your brain while you are performing. And I know this is something you've worked on as well with Greg. Greg has something called the focus band. And the premise there is it's measuring your brain waves. The brain is just a big ball of electricity, and it's measuring the frequency of your brain waves, and you're trying to get to a certain state. So, Greg, I'd love for you to just talk about that for a second, you know, what that is, what you're doing, and how it helps you. And then I'll tack on after that.
Yeah. So I use two things. I use focus band. I use another one called brain tap, which is a similar kind of concept. And I actually have worn both of them at the same time. I meditate with them on at night, and one of them helps me sleep. Brain tap helps me sleep really well, because sleep quality is massive. But anyway, the focus band is invented by some New Zealanders, and it is what they claim is it gets you into a state of motion, which is nothingness, is what they say, which is you're not thinking. Right, which is you are very sort. You're not conscious. You're just kind of. Usually, you're imagining something. I'll give you an example. I found a most successful state I can get into is there was a vacation I went on with my wife, and we were floating down a river on our backs. If I imagine that moment, it's awesome. Right, I'm very peaceful and tranquil. It's a great state to be in, and that's what this thing does. It measures you. Now, how that helps you, I have found that. Nothing ever guarantees success, but what it does is just a nice free state to play the game. And so often you will hit shots with this on where you are like, now what was I thinking about? And the answer is you don't know. You just hit it, right? You're being athletic. That's the piece of that I really enjoy.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I just want to give and we've talked about this before on the podcast. I'm going to give a 3-minute overview of neurologically what's going on and what that means. And we can maybe talk about some of the basic things you can do without getting into, you know, turning this into a PhD dissertation. So your ability to hit a golf shot exists in your brain. Your brain has all the instructions, and it's delivering those instructions to your muscles. Your muscles are executing the shots. No such thing as muscle memory. Muscles cannot retain or store information. So it has to get instructions from the brain, and these instructions are traveling down neural pathways, which are like roads that are going through the body. And when you get into high frequency brain waves, which is, you know, scared, nervous, excited, anxious, you know, pick your word, What happens is you go into high frequency. And when you get into high frequency, it's very challenging for those instructions to get to where they need to go effectively. Yeah. Yeah. So these roads, they get clogged up with traffic is a good way to think of it. And so the bit of information that needs to, you know, get your left wrist in flexion, it shows up a little bit late because it hit a traffic jam in your left elbow. And instead of your left wrist being 1 degree of flexion, it's 1 degree of extension, changes the club face in a big way, makes the ball go where you do not want it to go. So that's the first thing that happens when you're in this high frequency state. The second thing is you lose the ability to feel force effectively. So lag putting can become really troubling. You don't feel force in the right way. And a good way to explain that is if you've ever been really nervous or scared, your hands or arms start to feel heavy. They start to feel like stone. They feel odd, awkward. That's your brain being really challenged to feel force correctly. So that can show up in shots that you hit. It can show up in lag putting. We're always trying to control distance in some regard for the most part in golf. And that can be impacted when you are in high frequency mode. The last thing that it does is it hurts your ability to hold a target. So golf is one of the very few sports where you are basically almost never looking at the target unless you putt with heads up or it's a really close putt, which typically doesn't matter. But everything else, you're looking at your target and then you're looking down at the golf ball. Your brain has to hold where that target is.
Yeah.
And when you get into a high frequency mode, you lose the ability to hold that target. So when you see players hit big blocks, big pulls, a lot of people think it's swing related. There's a lot of factors at play. And one of them could be that your brain just moved the target and your body is reacting to it and trying to make the ball go to where it now thinks it is. Combine that with information showing up in incorrect order, incorrect sequence to the muscles, which can throw off how your swing is.
How you deliver it, yeah.
Yeah, combined with the ability to not feel force correctly, can make all of these things together increase the chances of you hitting a poor shot. Doesn't guarantee you're going to hit a poor shot. It increases the chances. And then the opposite's true. We're trying to get to low frequency. That's where you get into the zone. That's where you perform well. That's where all of these problems I just talked about don't really occur. Now, it doesn't guarantee you're going to hit a great shot. It just increases the chances, which is all we're trying to do. I know I'm going through this really quickly.
No, I think explained that really well. I think you've explained that in a way I think lots of people would relate to. If you're heading towards a 77 with four holes to go, you're probably going to start heading towards a higher frequency. And if you can't control that, in a sense, as you're saying, you're going to start getting confused with target. You're going to get traffic going to the parts of the body that need to deliver the club in theory, as I understand that. I think you explained that really well.
Yeah, exactly right. And so some of the things you can do about that, Greg talked about breathing techniques, extremely important. So if we were to have a machine hooked up to your brain, like Greg uses a consumer level device called Focus Band, or we had a, you know, academic medical EEG machine hooked up to your brain, when you take a deep breath, your brainwave frequency will get lower.
Yeah.
So it's extremely important to be breathing throughout the round in a way that's going to help lower brain frequency, either deep breathing. You can Google box breathing. And Greg probably has other breathing techniques that he applies as well. Those are really important. You can do other things to help lower frequency. And I don't know that we have time to get into all of them here, but focusing on things around you, engaging your senses basically is what is going to help lower your brainwave frequency. And for me, you know, I would read all these sports psychology books and I'd come away with, you know, interesting and, you know, useful tidbits. When I learn the neuroscience side of things, I understand now neurologically what's going on and all the things that you can do to control your brainwave frequency to get it lower, which is going to increase the likelihood of good performance, which is what we're trying to get to. I would definitely recommend Dr. Justice's book. It's called Jira Golf, spelled G-Y-R-A. It's a great, simple, easy read, and it's going to give you all the details that I'm just really breezing through right here very quickly. But I would definitely suggest you put it on your list because it was the most insightful book I've read on this topic.
Yeah, and I do think this topic is something that's so untouched. Certainly as a golf coach, this is something that we as coaches do not look at enough, and I think we should look at it more. There are more and more devices coming that will measure to a certain extent these frequencies that Lou is talking about. I spoke with someone literally last week about a device, and they showed me it in action, and it just blew my head off.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun. It didn't literally blow my head off, obviously, otherwise I'd have been very high frequency.
Yes. But
it did really, it was amazing to see them measuring my level of concentration, is how they described it, which was unbelievable. And then how easy it was for me to quickly change my levels of concentration with some simple techniques that then made me think, wow, yeah, you know, if you apply this on a grander scale and me practicing these techniques and learning what techniques get me in what they call the flow state, you know, so the non-thinking, you're just kind of flowing state. If I was competing, I would want to know this. And if obviously for people who are trying to break 80, shoot in the 70s consistently, this sounds a little bit, maybe something that they're not that interested in, and maybe that they're, I didn't take up golf to do, you know, mind stuff. But unfortunately, if you want to level what you're going to learn from all the episodes, and there's loads of other episodes, make sure you go through the back catalog if this isn't the one for you. We've got ones on driving and chipping and putting, so go and check them out as well. We're covering every part of the game. You're going to notice that to break in 80, it's about having a level performance as a caricatured way, isn't it? It's about not having spikes, low or high. Like, low's great, but they can often then create other spikes possibly. It's about trying to make your performance relatively level, and if you can stay level internally, you're only going to increase the chances in theory. Is that fair, guys, would you say?
I think if you're talking about like emotional control, Mark, is that what you're sort of talking about, like just not getting up?
Yeah,
too
well,
down
if you want a level performance. Yeah. I equate it to, I could walk across a beam now. You could put a beam on the ground and I could just walk across it. I wouldn't fall off. I'd just walk across it. You go and put that beam across the Grand Canyon, I'm not walking across it.
Right.
I could walk across it a million times on the ground, but you go and put it across the Grand Canyon, I'm all right, thanks.
Yeah.
Just that 1% chance of crashing is going to make me go, I don't want that challenge.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, the job itself hasn't changed, but the consequences have.
Yeah.
Right?
Correct. Yeah. Now, if you're heading towards a 77, your day means something different to all our audience who are trying to break 80. You're like, this is great. This is everything you practice. Your beam might now be on the Grand Canyon. It isn't. It's still a 77. It's not there. But you create these things often that you need to be able to control, which is what you said and what Lou's kind of hinting at as well, isn't it, Lou, with certain techniques?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of techniques you can apply here. And somebody like Greg is working on these extensively. It's a part of what he does to compete at a high level.
Yeah.
And these same techniques can apply to us everyday golfers, us book smart folk that like to play on the weekend.
So deep, Greg.
I've had to apply these own techniques to this podcast so I could get through it effectively. And it's working. It's working really
well.
You're
doing great, mate. Hang in there.
So these are things that you can apply to your own game, whether you're a tour pro, whether you're a 20 handicap, whether you're a 15 handicap. But you're trying to improve so you can get down to consistently shooting in the 70s. And Mark talked about, being, stable, emotional control, however you want to label it. What I've found in my own game and with other players that I've worked with on this topic is this really helps to make your bad rounds a lot better.
Yeah.
But it will improve your good rounds and your mediocre rounds, but it really helps to limit the damage in your bad rounds applying these techniques. It's really easy. Golf is a hard game. It's very easy to spiral out of control. You hit one off the hosel and a lot can start happening upstairs. It's like a tour pro when they miss a 20-inch putt. A lot starts happening. you know, if you have the techniques to minimize that damage, it's going to help improve your scores.
If you hit off the hosel, you're going to need more than focus band, bro.
You're going to, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
You're going to need a massage, some calming music, maybe sure. some nice pictures in front of you. Why do you have to bring the hosel up all the time?
Like, didn't we cover this? We don't talk about that.
Yeah. Just stop it down the neck for one episode.
Yeah, it's impossible. It's impossible. One more thing, and I know at time here. One more thing, and Greg said it earlier, but I have to repeat it. Sleep is incredibly important.
So
if you're trying to perform at your best, especially leading up to an event, you have to have good quality sleep. It helps in so many different ways. So it's such an important piece of the puzzle for this, and it will help to improve your scores by taking that part of your game seriously.
There you go. So if you are going to break 80, shoot in the 70s consistently, you've got to have had a good night's sleep. So get off the booze tonight or at the weekend, good night's sleep, and that score's there ready to go. But if that score isn't there ready to go, listen to our other episodes and we've got the answers, haven't we? We're answering every question here. You've literally pulled me and Greg down into the deepest of all the dives. I don't think Greg have ever dived this deep.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah, you know what? And I got to say, Mark, you very beautifully you've dumbed that down. So thank you. I appreciate that.
That is my skill. I will talk more highbrow when we turn the pod off, Lou. I was just for the average golfer. I was just trying to, you know, it wasn't going over my head at all. Yeah. There you go. Get some good sleep. Mental game, I think lots of people would agree the mental game is important. Lots of people do say it's important. But I would also argue for lots of you listening, you know, have you ever practiced improving your mental game? And for lots of people listening, it's probably no. And you are going to find over the next few years, I think, some real good research and case studies, ideas around how to improve this will start coming to the everyday golfer, not just for the tour pro. Certainly with some of the things I'm seeing coming out. So this part of your game can only get better. Thanks for listening. If you're enjoying the podcast, hit the likes as always. And remember, check out the other Break 80. This is part of a huge series trying to make sure that you get your lowest score and Break 80 and shoot in the 70s consistently.